Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for more traditional exercise such as weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447. Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute, on air and online, this is Intersection.
Hello and welcome to Intersection, where people and ideas meet online and on KBIA. I'm Ryan Famuliner. Some believe that learning and listening to music, particularly classical music, at a young age is tied to success in the future. In Columbia, there are many efforts to get children interested in classical music, multiple avenues for music education, and even classical music performances in town targeted at kids. Today on Intersection, we'll talk about how young people in Missouri are exposed to these influences and about some of the challenges in reaching them. Joining me in studio today, Kirk Trevor is the maestro of the Missouri Symphony Society. Kirk, welcome to Intersection.
Thank you, Ryan.
James Melton is the coordinator of the Fine Arts Department for Columbia Public Schools. James, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And Greg Hausman is the director of the Columbia Academy of Music. Greg, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks a lot.
And for you and our audience, are your kids interested in classical music? How do you get them more involved in it over the summer? Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You can also tweet us at intersectkbia. To watch our live show online today, go to rjionline.org/live. So you all work with kids in music, some in more regularly than others. So just to start off the question, why? Why is that important for young children, particularly to be exposed to music, to classical music? Whoever wants to dive in. Everybody's looking at
James. I'll go first, I guess.
Let you be the master.
I think the exposure to music, I mean, what I was just reviewing some comments and some notes from parents and things that kind of pour in towards the end of the year. And the biggest thing that comes across to me about being exposed to music is that we do it for a lot of reasons. They say increased test scores and that it makes us better, makes us better doing multiple things. But I think for me, the first and foremost is that it's art. It's relevant in everything that we do. It connects us to who we are as human beings, connects us to each other. And that's not necessarily something that we're going to get just naturally if we don't allow universal exposure to it and know what's been going on, you know, over time. So for me, the biggest thing to start with is that it's an expression of the human spirit and it's art. And I want to, you know, pursue that and give kids that opportunity to express themselves that way.
Sure. Kurt?
Yeah, I think that, like Graham said, I think that it's art. The thing about music is that we have both the passive and the active element in music of being listeners or proactive performers. And, you know, I don't like to separate them even that much. I like to think of, you know, that all of music is a proactive experience. And, you know, obviously we're going to be talking a lot to parents in the course of this afternoon. But I think the importance of music is being proven that because of the way that music engages the brain, it's just proven that by either by listening or being proactively involved in music and that you cannot be mindless. Yes. And I think that's one of the things that I like about music is that it's a constantly active activity.
Sure. And I guess, I mean, how do you see that, you know, I mentioned kind of really young children before too, but, you know, as you said, people are able to actively be engaged, you know, learning music and being able to, you know, not expand beyond that first sheet of music that they're looking at and really like diving into an instrument and all that. So what kind of difference do you see in an individual as they get a little older and they do have this, you know, exposure to music, I guess?
I think the danger is that we tend to mistakenly, you know, as teachers so often think that we're training musicians or we're giving lessons for people to become musicians. Mm. And in fact, you know, I think that we have to be careful not to get into that trap of thinking that we're developing or giving lessons and teaching. And all of us, I guess, here, you know, are well aware that 99.9% of young musicians who go on do not become musicians mm-hmm. as professionals. But the fact that one of our best examples in the conservatory program is Mingu Kim, you know, who is our concertmaster in the conservatory orchestra. He's been with us for 7 or 8 years. And he's going to Harvard in, I don't know whether it's thermonuclear biology or some extraordinary thing on, and he's a valedictorian at Hickman. And music has been a part of his life, and he's always accepted it. It's been one of the most important things, but it's not something he wants to do professionally. He wants to do it vocationally.
Yeah, and it's kind of a thing for children, you know, at an early age. It's kind of an opportunity for them to, like, really work on a semi-long-term goal. You know what I mean? Like, I'm going to learn this instrument and actually play this performance at a certain date coming up in several months or something like that. It's, you know, a certain discipline develops there, which is nice. But, you know, for me, the big thing is just, like, you know, I like to teach because I feel like it's a really positive thing that people can get into.
Mm-hmm.
You know, kind of leaving the better world, or leaving the world a better place, if you will, I
sure.
guess is what I'm thinking there.
Sure. Well, and like you said, I mean, it is in some ways, and it's some of the research I've read on, you know, whether listening to music and playing an instrument, you know, will lead to a, you know, a more active mind in the future. They also say, it really, it's also, it's the same type of person, right, that is going to be dedicated to this ritual, to spending a lot of time and, you know, learning this instrument. It's not something you're going to pick up and learn in a few hours, right? And so that seems like, yeah, I see you nodding your head over there.
Yeah.
I mean,
not a few hours.
Yeah, yeah. And so I mean,
certainly. Exercise
yeah.
and dedication.
Exactly. And so, are those types of students you often find yourself working with, someone who really is able to dedicate themselves maybe more than their peers?
I think that you find that kids that want to continue or that get some sort of immediate feedback or jolt from the experience are kids that continue. But I also find myself, particularly with, because singing was my avenue, that's where I went with musicians, but always in support of the greater musician culture at whole, about what that process is. But I think it's those kids that go on for further study, it's because they feel a direct connection to enjoyment, enrichment. They like what they're doing, and some see it as an ultimate goal, like they want to become mm-hmm. musicians, but others just see it as a relative part of their life kind of experience. I see it almost as an extension of, I wouldn't expect my daughter to leave elementary school without being able to read, and I don't expect her to leave elementary school without the ability to participate and read music, because it's such a vibrant part of our culture. It's how we relate and talk to people. We go to concerts, we see events, we hear music on the radio. And so even kids that don't go to that musician level, receiving that training, whether it be in an instrument or whether it be voice or some sort of avenue of participation now in the music industry that's out there in production, it's about being part of that active community. And for me, that's just really relevant right now.
And I think that for the instrumentalist that I work with, obviously, you know, there's two elements here. One is that the students in the conservatory obviously have to play instruments that require a fair amount of money to maintain and, mm-hmm. and keep mm-hmm. and to buy in the first place. So I think that obviously parental influence is there from the beginning in a way of support. But I again want to get back to this, remind ourselves that music isn't just about Bach and Beethoven and classical
Correct.
Music. It's mm-hmm. very important that we don't stereotype musicians or myself or James or Greg here as classical nerds. You know, I mean, the fact is that I probably in the hot summer night spend more time playing non-traditional classic than pop and new world, world music and every kind of music. So, you know, I think it's important for us to say that a kid that enjoys music may be as interested in, you know, ethnomusicology and world music and playing, you know, South African drums as much as playing Bach on a violin.
Hey, take a moment to remind our audience, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Famuliner, and today we're talking about the opportunities and challenges for youth music education in Missouri. Joining us in the studio today for the conversation, Kirk Trevor is the maestro of the Missouri Symphony Society. James Melton is the coordinator of the Fine Arts Department for Columbia Public Schools. And Greg Hausman is the director of the Columbia Academy of Music. And for you in our audience, how do you think schools can educate students in music, specifically classical music? We'd like to hear what you think. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia. And so to get back to that idea that, you know, music is, for most of the students, not going to be a vocation, mm-hmm. Do parents accept that, embrace that? I mean, I'm thinking like an allegory to, you know, the kid playing baseball, playing t-ball, right? And they think that their kid's going to be a professional someday, right? Is that a problem for musicians, young musicians' parents as well? Or I mean, since it is an investment, right? I mean,
it certainly is, but I think most parents realize that their kids are not going to be rich as a professional musician, where they might be rich as a professional baseball player.
Sure, this is true, but still, I don't know.
Sure, I mean, I think they look more for that level of dedication. If the child continues to show interest and is really enjoying what they're doing, which happens in a lot of cases, then they support it because, you know, this is bringing joy to their child. So what's wrong with that exactly? Mm-hmm. But that's not every child, of course. You know, a lot of, especially the younger you go, the more likely a child is to sort of lose focus or change interests very suddenly. But yeah, sure. I mean, you really got to kind of, once again, put the focus back on the parents there at an early age. My experience has kind of been children at a very early age only have the experience with the music that their parents have exposed them to.
Sure.
And so that's where the limit is.
Yeah, I think that is the important issue about what the children have been exposed to. Obviously, you know, I grew up in an age when the radio was actually important in people's lives, and one would hope that it would be the same today, but it's not.
Yeah.
But in terms of having a radio going all day long, BBC Three was going. I mean, the amount of music I heard between the ages of 4 and 18, by the time I was in college in London, I probably heard more music than I think most musicians do in a lifetime in this country, simply because, you know, having it on 24 hours a day and being able to listen to the great performances all the time. So, I mean, that's one area of exposure. The other, of course, is live music, taking children to live performances. And we're lucky here in Colombia that we have many, many wonderful, not only grassroots groups, but semi-pro amateur groups that that bring great music to life. And then we have the professional summer season here with the Hot Summer Nights, so there's certainly plenty of opportunities. And our focus, my focus in the summer as part of Hot Summer Nights, is the family series, because we believe that the family series is the way to expose the ages, you know, 2, 3 to, you know, whatever. It's a great way for all ages to be in the hall together and have that experience of live music. And you know, you can tell kids about it, but it's like that first experience of going to the baseball field or the baseball game, you know, in St. Louis or Kansas City. You know, nobody forgets the first time they walk up the stairs and they see the field itself. The same in the concert hall. Mm-hmm.
And at the Hot Summer Nights performances you're talking about, sometimes you even give them a chance to get their hands dirty, right? Go up and...
Oh, I mean, we like the kid to get their hands dirty. And in fact, you know, you'd be surprised how much the orchestra actually enjoys the letting kids conduct. I mean, it started, it used to be 10 or 12 kids would come up, and now it's more like 200, 300 kids. And so we've had to expand that section of the program. We used to play one march, and now we play like 3 marches in a row so that the orchestra doesn't get tired of playing the same piece. But, yeah, I mean, it's... we want the experience of music. You know, we want kids to experience it. You know, but the sad thing, I think, is that we can kind of think back and have this image in the 1950s, 60s, and even the 70s of kids going to young people's concerts, you know, mm-hmm. whether they were called YPCs or children's concerts. But your school would go to the local hall with the local symphony orchestra, and the teachers would lecture their kids before about when to applaud and how to behave and no spitballs, and if I see any of you throw your programs, and you know, it was always a don't do this kind mm-hmm. of experience, and most of the kids didn't want to be there. And I, in my experience of young people's concerts, which I've been doing for 35 years, if you made the concert fun and enjoyable and proactively involving and engaging for the kids, then they could be educated in the midst of entertainment. Mm-hmm. The problem that has been, I think, for a lot of it is that we think education first and entertainment as a byproduct. I think it should be entertainment first and education as a very big byproduct, because the interesting thing was when I did a series of programs with MTV for Knoxville's middle school, you know, people avoided middle school young people's concerts for obvious reasons. You know, it was considered to be a very...
Amateur.
Yes, unappreciative audience. Sure. You know, it'll go. And so we did.
I love them.
We did
unappreciative of the classics, and we did a program with MTV in which we had a number of MTV artists actually dance, sing two classical works, and then we showed it up on the TV, and we turned the whole concert into an award show. So that, you know, there would be different awards for the best ballet written by a Russian composer, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And we'd have different candidates, and they come out and win, you know, get their Tony. Mm-hmm. And the kid couldn't actually relate to this whole concept, you know, of, and they would see the MTV. So Janet Jackson actually danced to the Firebird in our program. And what was interesting, obviously the kids were enjoying the video and the game and the whole the concert format. But when we were told that when the students got back to school, they remembered everything that had happened. They remembered the names of the composers, what the pieces were called, you know, which was much more so than if we'd have told them that just as an educational program. They would have forgotten that information. But because that information came as a byproduct of entertainment, so I'm really a believer in entertaining and education being really hand in hand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, James, I see you nodding. I wonder, too, your thoughts on just trying to get teen students engaged in music and in what works, I guess.
I think that's exactly the key. I mean, I hesitate to even call it entertainment. Great performance should always be rewarding and should always be enriching. And I think it's sometimes just forgetting that we participate and go out and see live performances because we find it entertaining and enriching and rewarding. And so I think it's finding those pieces, finding those things, finding those ways to communicate to students that really hook them, that get them to ask questions, to think deeper about it. Because once they start asking, they just jump off to the next thing. And they do remember, they do connect to that. And if you make it something that's, you know, rewarding for them, that's when they ask a question about, I wonder what it would be like to go get lessons or to think about playing that. How long did it take you to do that? I remember back to when I was at Lang, we had the opportunity to have, and I think it was Katarina Finch, it was a harpist that came out and was the harp for Her Majesty, and it was a neat opportunity through the concert series. She was fantastic, and what she did was spent most of her time allowing the kids to explore the harp rather than playing and doing, for the most part at the beginning, just tricks. And then played a few pieces for them, but spent so much time engaging them in what it is she did and how she did it that a lot of those kids turned around and went to the concert. They were provided opportunity to see that through the concert series for free. And then we had a couple students later that ended up taking lessons, and they were deeply engaged in it. And it wasn't stuffy. It wasn't old fashioned. And it was really relevant to them. And so I think it's finding those ways to begin with that entertainment idea, connecting to them in real ways. That idea of an award show is a fantastic way because you didn't dumb down the music or the performance. The performance was still high caliber and artistic, but yet it was in a language or in a way that spoke to them. And I think that's key and critical.
Does that surprise the kids sometimes that they actually find themselves interested in this thing they didn't think they were interested in?
Absolutely. I think it shocks them when they realize that, this just isn't my grandmother or my grandfather's music. And they also make the connection to how much of it is just sort of in their everyday lives. They don't realize where they've heard that piece or where they know something from, but all of a sudden they recognize it because you start helping them see the connections, and then they start asking questions, and it's fantastic.
Yeah. Sometimes framing something like that in a different way is an easier way to get to students. I think we kind of mentioned that a little earlier, you know. Not necessarily just coming out with classical music, but I think a lot of people, especially as they get into high school and stuff, they want to think of like cool music as something they get to find in sort of the underground. You know, it's not something you find from your teachers at school necessarily, but eventually if they can make that connection and see that all of the elements are there, when you study classical music, it's still going to be a great value to you if you wanted to be in rock or hip hop or electronic musician of some kind, you know.
Mm-hmm. You kind of just gravitate back, I guess.
Yeah, so each student has some interest, and you know, eventually if something connects that interest to the world of classical music, then suddenly there it is for them to enjoy for their life.
Right.
I mean, it's an interesting point because, you know, the reality is that so many rock musicians, pop musicians are classical musicians, classically trained. I mean, I was a cellist with Genesis, right at the beginning of the Genesis era, when we started in 1969, 1970, because we were all at Guildhall together, Mike Rutherford and Phil Collins and these guys. The fact is that a lot of, the Beatles, the 60s, the pre-60s, was not the case. But once the kind of 70s came, a lot of popular musicians, and it's even more so now, come out of a classical training. And Genesis was the best example, because nearly all of the guys in Genesis had come as truly great classical musicians. Mm-hmm. I mean, Mike Rutherford was a great guitarist, we were just experimenting with digital and electronic at that time. But, Phil Collins was a drummer at that time.
Yeah, exactly.
Take a moment to remind our audience, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Famuliner. Today we're talking about the opportunities and challenges for youth music education in mid-Missouri. Joining us in studio today for the conversation, Kirk Trevor is the maestro of the Missouri Symphony Society. James Melton is the coordinator of the Fine Arts Department for Columbia Public Schools. And Greg Hausman is the director of the Columbia Academy of Music. We'd also love to hear from you in our audience today. Do your children play music? What are some of the barriers that you experience in accessing that education? Share your thoughts. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You can also tweet us at intersectkbia. We'd like to remind you can watch Intersection as streaming video online during our live conversations every Monday afternoon at 2 at kbia.org. You can also watch that video and join our online chat by going to kbia.org and scrolling down to the link for Intersection. Again, that's Mondays at 2 online at kbia.org. And I would like to get to that topic of barriers here in a moment, but I wondered just quickly, maybe, James, you could talk a little about that. There is a partnership with the Met Opera that kind of fits into the conversation that we just talked about. Talk a little about that.
So I don't know if I came to opera naturally. In fact, I know I didn't. I came to it through a friend when I came down to the University of Missouri. I was always sort of lightly interested in it, but I was more of a musical theater guy and then was going into music ed. But got my early education from a friend who was a Joan Sutherland fan and quickly dived into his recordings and over time just really fell in love with it. So a few years ago, the Metropolitan Opera started their HD Live broadcast series. And that's been going on for 7 or 8 years now after Peter Gelb took over there at the Met. But they started an education series in which they were inviting New York City public schools as well as other regional schools that had the broadcast in a local theater and giving them resources to help prepare kids, much like the young people's concerts, and then taking them to one of those broadcasts. We were selected last year after working with them and kind of signing up to be a Missouri site. They had relatively few schools in the Midwest that were participating. It was mainly East Coast, West Coast thing. Now we have some schools, and we have one in Missouri. We might be adding another. There's a couple in Texas. We have one in Minnesota. But essentially, we choose 4 operas, and we're taking each of the high schools, as well as Lee Elementary, which is our fine arts elementary here in Columbia. And like I'll use Lee as the best example, I think, or one of the most representative of our first year involved. We had 50 tickets available to us to take young students. I went and worked with the 4th and 5th graders to prepare them to see La Cenerentola, which is a lovely Rossini opera, and did some pre-work with them. We even got the opportunity working through the Met to do a live Google Hangout with Joyce DiDonato, which, if you don't know her, is a local Midwest girl who is made great in, you know, world-renowned mezzo-soprano, and she made these brilliant connections with kids about what it was like to sing this role for over 17 years, talk about how she got involved, and it was just so real for them. And then we got to go to that performance on Saturday, and what they get to see is the grand spectacle that is opera. It's not this isolated voice that's singing on a recording, which is how I enjoy listening to it, but most people need to see it in its theatrical format, that it's stage and costumes and scenery and great design and great music, and the classical music just comes along for the ride. And now not only have they been exposed to great theater, but now kids are talking about Rossini and the fireworks. And in fact, we're probably going to take Lee again next year to another Rossini opera because the kids were so engaged by these, you know, fireworks that go off in the voice ranges. So it's a really exciting partnership. We get to do that with 4 sites, and they're doing it all across the country. And I think it's the mission behind it really is to keep what could potentially be a dying art form, not fall off. It is the people's art form. It's for the everyday Joe. They want people, you know, you don't have to dress up in your Sunday's best in order to go to the opera. You can slap on a polo and a nice pair of slacks and show up at the Met and see opera anytime. And they're trying to lower that threshold so that people realize the doors are open, the tickets are available. And so a kid that sees their first HD live broadcast and then takes a trip to New York later in their life might just show up at the Met to go see, you know, what whatever might be showing up there, which is fantastic.
We actually have a caller on the line. I wanted to bring him on real quick. David from Columbia. David, are you there?
I am.
Hi, yeah, thanks for calling today.
Thanks. So I have a comment for the moderator and then a comment slash question for the panelists. I think the first thing I would observe is that KBIA is, in fact, quite an asset in these regards in terms of its all-day classical formatting, that this is music that can be listened to while one does anything, and that families can have playing in the presence of their children, just like one of your panelists mentioned the BBC 3 years ago. And that is not common in a city of our size, a town of our size, our small size. And I think that's a great advantage, and I think kudos to the station for doing that.
Well, thank you for
children
that.
Too. For the panelists, my curiosity is regarding people who are musicians and children who are learning music and people who are instructors of music all agree on the topics that you've been discussing. And so there's clearly some gap somewhere else. And I'm thinking about things like standardized testing in the schools that don't ever seem to address instrumental music or fine arts performances. And I'm thinking about a legislature which never seems to really talk about those things. And I'm wondering about what kind of contribution the State Department of Education makes, if at all, to the furtherance of these things. And I'm curious about the panelists' notions about governmental support, interest, or even acceptance of the continued focus on these subjects and what they think might or could be done by citizens or others to help galvanize and aggregate that support.
Great question. Thanks, David.
That's a fantastic question.
I think we're going to finish that in the 2 minutes before the break. We'll come back to it, too. But, James, I saw you nodding throughout that call. David, thanks so much for the question.
I think it's difficult on many levels because there are barriers due to standardized testing and things that we're up against. But I don't really see it as a barrier if we find the ways that we work in tandem and find the ways that we know that we're supporting what are great standards for kids. Quality learning happens all the time, and we need to be accountable for knowing how students and when students have learned. But it's also finding those support pieces that I think is clearly, you know, borne out in research and other things, that music education and fine arts education in general improve what's going on there. I don't know if the connections are as real as some people would like them to be, because they love to see, well, if I take this course, it has this outcome. Well, we can't really base all of education, particularly fine arts education, on some sort of immediate gain in a test score. Because if we try to do that, we'll never find it, to be quite honest. But if we look over the life of what a person gains through study and through understanding and enjoyment, we know that it has an impact on their ability to be a cognitive, great thinking person. So I think in Columbia, we particularly see a lot of support for the fine arts in the public schools. Would we as fine art educators always love there to be more? You betcha. We would like as much time as we could get with students. But we don't suffer from any lack of having access to all kids, especially at the elementary level. And then as we cross into middle school, helping them to find opportunities to get great music education, you know. And it, I don't know if that's necessarily true statewide.
Well, I think also the first time I heard about, you know, string teachers being cut out of the schools was back in 1970s when I first came to the States, and there was this bemoaning for a number of years because it was tragic, of course, that instrumental teachers were being taken out of elementary schools and band programs were starting later, et cetera, et cetera. But we've kind of had that happening for 30 to 35 years, and I think what's happened is that groups like the symphony, in fact, symphony orchestras that I've been involved with, 4 symphony orchestras that have tried to take up the slack.
Unfortunately, I have to interrupt you, but we'll pick that up right after the quick break. Guest today, Kirk Trevor, the Maestro of the Missouri Symphony Society, James Melton, the Coordinator of the Fine Arts Department for Columbia Public Schools, and Greg Hausman, the Director of Columbia Academy of Music. I'm Ryan Fumulner. We'll be right back after this short break. Welcome back to Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Famulner, and today we're talking about the opportunities and challenges for youth music education in mid-Missouri. Joining us in studio today for the conversation, Kirk Trevor is the maestro of the Missouri Symphony Society. James Melton is the coordinator of the Fine Arts Department for Columbia Public Schools. And Greg Hausman is the director of the Columbia Music Academy, Academy of Music, rather. And for you and our audience, what do you think the benefits are for children to be exposed to classical music or to learn to play an instrument? Share your thoughts. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia or join our online chat. So, Kirk, I interrupted you right in the middle of the thought about how for 30 years we've seen this threat.
We've seen a slight decline in the number of school applied teachers in elementary school. And I think the symphony orchestra, certainly the symphony community, understood there was a need for us to become involved, not just as a place where children came to listen to us, but to become proactively involved in the school. And so a lot of programs have happened where symphony orchestras have been taking their players into schools in small groups and not doing peripatetic teaching, but perhaps inspiring kids to want to ask the question, you know, how do I study and where do I? And of course, symphonies have major ways in which they go after funding to help them with new initiatives. And in Knoxville, we had a new initiative, which was exactly this. We took a number of our, we hired a number of young new string players into the symphony orchestra, and half of their job was to go into the schools and help with instrumental teaching, and half was to play for the symphony. Here in Columbia, we have the conservatory, which we started in 2007, which is a program that is obviously geared to students that either have been taking lessons already, especially in the string area through our very large Suzuki program, or through some of our sister schools that have been very supportive, like Gentry Middle, with the band programs, and have created a program that now has 183 students in choir and two orchestras. And the reason I bring that up is so that parents know that even if their child doesn't have the opportunity to learn an instrument in elementary school, a stringed instrument, for example, the conservatory or the symphony can help all types. There are lots of financial ways in which we can make it possible for all children. We have the same saying. We don't want any child to be left behind from being able to learn an instrument. And we keep using this word classical because, you know, it seems like that the place where most instruments start with the classical. But again, you know, I want to say that we're supporters of all kinds of music, whether it's rock, pop, movie, opera. You know, music is music. It's the same brain function that's being used to absorb a symphony by Beethoven as it is to absorb a pop song by, you know, whoever, by Lady Gaga. I mean, I had the conservatory orchestra playing a Lady Gaga tune last year because I thought it was important that they play music that is relevant to them. And so the conservatory offers this program through the symphony.
And so that, what I'm hearing, too, though, is that this is, you know, a group that has decided this is something that's important, and it's a you know, kind of a passion project, right, kind of to fill in a need that maybe isn't being, you know, that is maybe falling to the wayside elsewhere. Because as we were talking about before the break, I mean, if you're not going to see a result in test score, which is where money has to go when you're talking about education right now, it's a little more difficult to you know, have this funding coming from the regular sources, right? I mean, you kind of have to have someone step up. I mean, that's not necessarily a Columbia problem, right?
That's where you end up with people like us who are, you know, musicians or music appreciators or actually in the business of it. You know, we kind of have to be the lobbyists, as it were, for these sorts of things. I mean, the incoming superintendent was on the show just a couple of months ago with a laundry list of things to worry about, and very few of those had anything to do with fine arts specifically, right?
Right.
So the people that are already really interested in fine arts have to sort of remind people how important that is sometimes, I think, a little bit.
And I think it's, I mean, what's important is that public school in particular, although we have great private institutions as well that do great music education, thinking of CIS and Emily Edgington and other people that are doing fabulous things around town, they can only take music education so far, and then there has to be supplemental resources and access to community arts events that bring it, you know, bring that fabric to life, and also take us into those areas where we want to specialize or where we have more interest. If I, you know, if I'm more interested in pop or rock and those types of things, I might head towards a Palin Music or, you know, a Columbia Academy of Music, yeah, where I might have access to artists that do that. The same with the Missouri Symphony Society. And I sort of see our job a lot of times as being the opportunity that opens the window, that gives a view of what can I access? My biggest fear in life, at least in Missouri, is that I don't think we're there yet, but if we don't have people that are doing strong advocacy, like Kirk and Greg, and just community members in general to answer the caller question and before, contacting board members, contacting teachers and principals, administrators, and telling them how much they value what is there, ultimately the supplemental will begin to supplant what's going on in the classroom. And we don't want that to happen because we need both in tandem to build adults that are, you know, musicians for life is kind of my goal. You can see yourself musician, whether you're amateur, you know, the casual academic who just is passively taking in the concert material, or the pro or the semi-pro that goes out there because you had this education all the way along the way. And if we ever lose any of that, that's where I get worried, is where the supplemental begins to supplant what's going on, because people think that's enough and it isn't. If you're really going to have a quality experience, you need both.
I would agree with that pretty much wholeheartedly. I mean, you can see that easily in any students that would come in to take private lessons. If they're in a music program at school, they're the students generally that are going to excel, because they have, you know, more than one resource to learn from, for one thing. That's a big thing. Just learning every single thing about music from one single person will leave you very limited.
Sure.
So having that experience on both ends, I think, is really important for increasing your abilities as a musician.
And it's a question of opportunities, isn't it? I mean, as James said, if we have X number of students in our elementary school, you know, it's important that we allow all 100% of them to have the exposure, whether it's through the school's own programs or outside resources that can come and bring them in. I mean, that's the difference between here and Europe, obviously, growing up in Europe as I did, where state funding and still today, the state take care of most of the arts programs and bringing into the schools, and it's there. Whether we agree politically or not, whether government should have a role to play in arts funding, I don't think that's here nor there, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I think that between the system that we live in today in the United States, the symphonies and the advocates will supplement what is and is not there in the school to try and give the best opportunities for all children.
Yeah,
I agree.
And James, you're relatively new to this program too. I wonder your thoughts of the lay of the land now and some goals you have, I guess, just having taken stock of where you're at.
I think for us, or at least where I see where we're headed right now, is that we have a pretty strong fine arts offering in general, K through 12, vocal, instrumental, and then I think art as well as theater, depending on where those things come in. Music-wise, what I would like to see is a continuing of allowing the elementary programs to be the window that offers lots of connection to what's going on. I think on some levels, our elementary program can be a bit stiff or stodgy, depending on, you know, the relative newness of individuals in that. But overall, we have excellent music educators there. And so my goal for them is to continue making sure they're opening that window and seeing the whole breadth and not just, you know, focusing on one element, not Western music alone, but world music and pop music and finding all those things. And plus now getting them excited about technology and the way that that connects us to a whole world of music that wasn't available to us before. And the instantaneous creation of music on devices is pretty spectacular when you think about what can come in for the education point of view. As we cross into middle school, which is where we get instrumental, really the introduction of instrumental music, I want to see a lowering of the barrier of access to instruments. What we have are, in general, kids that have families of moderate means to exceptional means can get access to an instrument almost at any given point and do something that they enjoy. If you struggle with access to that instrument, sometimes that excludes you from that experience, and maybe singing isn't what you're interested in. So we need to continue to focus on being able to lower the barrier and finding ways to get instruments in the hands of kids. And it's really important to make sure that you get the instrument, not just because that's what's available in the school district, especially at sixth grade, for the larger, more expensive instruments, of particularly like brass, tuba, baritone, cello, bass. We provide these to students because the barrier to getting them is too high. The rental is too expensive. But what if that's not the natural inclination of the student or the interests? So we need to make sure that we have other ways to do that. And then we need to find ways to keep it relevant for them as they cross over into high school and not set necessarily the sights ultimately on becoming the performer or the professional, but as I'm kind of coining it right now, the aficionado or the casual academic, somebody that wants to participate because they love it, they enjoy it, and they can make that work with their high school schedules. We have such an emphasis on academic rigor and excellence that sometimes I think we push kids out because they feel like they can't keep it as part of their academic high school schedule. It is where we do really rely on community outlets for people to participate in those things still, but we would like them to be able to feel that they can continue all the way through high school. That's where we're really struggling right now.
We really struggle, and some of our high school students come to me and say, you know, we have an unwritten policy that all students in the conservatory will be students within their own school program, because we obviously must want to and wholeheartedly support all school programs. But the way scheduling has happened, has evolved in the last few years, it's made it, and remembering that probably our high school instrumental students in a conservatory happen to be, either because they've been doing music for so long, the smartest kids. And so they're in advanced placement courses.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
They can't take orchestra. They can't take choir. You know, they end up having to take some other classes and then they find themselves out of the music program in their own school, which then reflects poorly on us sometimes, because teachers think that we're advocating them not being part of their own school program. So we just want people to know that we strongly support and advocate that all students in conservatory would be in school programs. We do have a lot of homeschoolers, of course, obviously, but it's sad that obviously having strong academic kids in an orchestra, you do run into some of these problems. And
it's that culture also that I think, I mean, for me, I love that idea that when we see kids involved in these types of programs, private lessons of all sorts to ensemble, these are strong academic kids, and that's what we want for every student, is a strong, you know, that. And that's how you get that. You become part of that culture of other people that are doing those things that, you know, make them excel and build that culture of excellence. Mm-hmm. And if we lower the barriers for participation, make sure that we have all those accesses, talking to parents about making sure they go in and have great conversations with their guidance counselors about why isn't it possible for my child to take this AP course and this ensemble that they want to be involved in? Why do they conflict? We can't have everything. I mean, there are limits to what is possible in the daily high school schedule or middle school schedule. But I really do think we try at every turn to work with parents and families and students to find that road if they want to be there. Mm-hmm. And students just asking questions, making sure they tell the adults in their lives, I'm interested in doing that. Because if they never voice the opinion and giving kids the strength to have that voice, then there are adults out there that will advocate for them and find those resources. I think about right now with Nellie Roach, who worked with me and the Columbia Public Schools Foundation to try to get some scholarships this summer to the Hot Summer Nights
Academy.
And we're doing that right now, finding kids that either would have a difficult time participating due to financial needs or are new to the program, and getting them access through their teachers nominating them and saying, this is a kid that spoke up and said, I'm interested. So those are those opportunities.
Greg, I wonder where you think Columbia Academy Music fits into this as well, as far as, you know, getting, like you said, getting instruments in the hands of students, and just, I guess, what kind of demographics you see coming through there.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we do charge for lessons there, so it's not the same thing as a public school situation. But, I mean, affordability of instruments certainly is a factor when people are thinking about what, you know, what can I actually let my child learn to do here, right? If they're already in a program at school, then that helps a lot, because they've got an instrument they can use, especially, like you said, if it's a very costly instrument like a tuba or something like that. And we also, you know, can help people rent instruments and stuff like that at reasonable rates. But, you know, you see a lot of people that just basically want to, I would say, convince their child to take guitar lessons because they can get a guitar so much cheaper than they can get a horn or a piano or something. But I think that's a mistake, honestly, especially at a very early age. I think kids really take well to these other instruments, you know, especially piano. If you can just get a playable piano or keyboard for your child to practice on. I mean, that's a great place to start at very early age, in my opinion. I would suggest anybody that can do that, try to do that.
And even if it's not piano in home, I think about a student that I knew early on that didn't have access to an instrument in the house, and we worked out a situation where practice happened at school in the mornings, or they also took advantage of religious institutions around town that have those instruments and have the doors open for them to come and practice. So,
take a moment to remind our audience, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Famuliner, and today we're talking about the opportunities and challenges for youth music education in Missouri. Joining us in studio today for the conversation, Kirk Trevor is the maestro of the Missouri Symphony Society, James Melton is the coordinator of the Fine Arts Department for Columbia Public Schools, and Greg Hausman is the director of the Columbia Academy of Music. And for you and our audience, are you going to any music festivals this summer? What are your favorites? Let us know by giving us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia. We've kind of talked about this as the show's gone on, but I would like to hear from each of you, really, if we can, what you think the biggest barrier is to kids getting into music right now, to children getting into music, and the thing that you'd like to see addressed right away, if possible, or you're trying to address. Many of you are right now.
Well, I think the biggest barrier is a psychological one, that it's not cool. And so, you know, there's a saying that we've been using a lot, is it's not Beethoven that's the problem, it's the way we present Beethoven that's the problem. And I think that once we start to present it in a manner that makes it a little more accessible and cool for kids to not feel that playing an instrument is a nerdy thing to do, then I think, you know, that's obviously going to be a long-term change in cultural thinking. But I think it will happen, because I think that the technology is now enabling more and more kids to see it. YouTube has made cool things available. I mean, one of the coolest things I saw was an incredible guitarist who plays Bach violin sonatas on the guitar, a very famous rock guitarist who does YouTube of classical pieces played on a guitar. Things that you would least expect, you know. I have the same kind of feeling about taking the orchestra into places where people don't expect us to be. Obviously, the concert hall is a very intimidating place, and I'm well aware of that. And when we have our family concerts, our first is this coming Wednesday, and it's Peter and the Wolf with the Missouri Contemporary Ballet. Mm. And the whole purpose and the hope is that the concert hall just becomes a user-friendly place where kids can come up onto the stage, conduct the orchestra. After the concert, we have an instrumental petting zoo, in which they can come and actually play and touch the instrument, meet young players, some of our conservatory students, and see their own peers playing the instrument. So the barrier, I think, is finding a way to take away some of the stigma and some of the preconceptions about instrumental playing that have been there for so many years, and make it a cooler thing to do.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with a lot of that. One thing, though, I mean, even for, you know, youngsters who aren't so worried about things being cool, I mean, even people who are proudly geeks, you know, there's, I guess, just the proliferation of the internet alone, you could see there's a whole lot of information for a lot of diverse interests out there that, once again, could pull some away. You know, instead of being a music geek, maybe they want to become a metalworking geek or something. Who knows? You know, any other thing in the world. So, you know, we're also bombarded with a lot of media. I see a lot of people with young children. They kind of, you know, I've seen a lot of toddlers with much nicer tablets than I've ever been able to afford and use, basically. You know, just sitting there playing video games on them. And I found at a pretty early age that the same sort of reward in your brain that you feel when you successfully play well at an instrument, or you achieve a goal that you're basically trying to do when you're taking lessons or learning at school, you get that same charge of excitement in your brain that you would when you are winning at a video game. But it's much more substantial because you worked at it for so much longer, and it's so much more real, you know. Mm-hmm. But it's a compatible feeling. So I think any kid that's has a lot of fun sitting there playing a game on his tablet is going to have a lot more fun playing an instrument if we can just convince their parents that they want to steer them in that direction.
But that instant gratification is a lot easier, isn't it?
It sure is. It sure is. And that's really, really hard to compete with. And I think that's a big barrier.
And I think you put your finger on something very important. I mean, I mentioned it earlier, that we need to be really reaching out to the parents at wherever they are, whether it's on, listening to this radio station, whether it's through the PTA, you know, whatever chance we have to reach out to parents who have children of this age group that we're talking about, because they can be the motivating force as well. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, obviously if we reach all parents in some way and say, here's the opportunity, do you want your kid to have it, then they make that choice. Now, on a secondary level, you don't want children to be prevented by the choices of their parents.
Sure.
James, I wonder, you've actually the idea of the biggest barrier. I mean, we've talked again a lot of them, but is there any we haven't talked about yet?
I think it just as we come around the table and think about that, that psychological barrier, something that tears that down, getting them not to be so worried about the instant gratification, finding that long term, and then just making it really relevant to them as something as part of their everyday life. I talk a lot about and did in my classroom that. It's about, I want you to see yourself as a musician, that title is not reserved for the elite in our society. It is reserved for all people that partake in the community. You're a musician no matter what your skill level, and that, you know, artistry is not something that you ever really achieve. You get to one goal and you accomplish something and then the goal moved. You got to do something else and you got to keep going. It is a lifelong pursuit. And you can feel proud of it, you know, even in the instantaneous moment, just finishing that one lesson page in piano right now, or when you first begin, or guitar, or wherever you're at, is a way to celebrate and enjoy that. But there's something more to do. It's a never-ending thing. And so I think if we can just get parents and kids and family and community members to know how relevant it is to what we, you know, what we want to do in life, regardless of what your vocational pursuit is.
I mean, you know, Mozart was certainly the Justin Bieber of his day,
uh-huh.
or the Elvis
without
of his day.
Doubt.
You know, I mean, Mozart, Beethoven, Paganini certainly was the Elvis of his day. They were trying to tear his hair out all the time.
They were celebrities.
They were celebrities, and they were megastars because they played the popular music of their day. Now we kind of have made it dead. They're just dead white guys who lived in a European.
We can't change that, right?
But dead European guys.
Yeah.
You know, and the trouble is that's why coming to talking about composition, you know, being allowing young children. I mean, we have this amazing program here in this town through the Thinkerville Foundation
program.
Where we have more incredible young composers than probably any other town in America, simply because the opportunity was there. And for not only for them to learn how to write, but to have performances of their works.
I want to bring in really quickly, we have another caller. Andrea is on the line from Columbia. Andrea, are you there?
I'm here.
Hi, thanks for calling today.
Hi, thanks for having me on. I just want to say thanks for running the program, and we're a big supporter of the fine arts in the schools. I'm also a parent to three children in CPS at different levels. And my comment today runs along the lines of how to make music cool for kids. And it's a thank you to send out to the Columbia Public School Paxton Keeley. This past year, my fourth grader took up the banjo. And of his own gumption, he wanted to go in and perform. So he would just load up his banjo some days, and the teachers always welcomed him to come in and play it. And he'd bring it in about once a month. They were very receptive to it. They just let it be a casual thing. And then by the end of the year, his last performance, he performed for eight different classes because he either said, can I come in and play, or the teachers asked him, hey, you're walking down the hall with your banjo. We heard you. Can you come in and play for our class? And the kids were receptive, and it was very encouraging to him. So I just want to say thank you to the Paxton Keeley teachers.
Well, thank you, Andrea.
Thank you. Thanks for calling in. Thanks for that story. We appreciate
it.
Sure.
Yeah, so some good positive reinforcement there from their peers, which that may be, is that another thing? I mean, really,
I think it's huge. I mean, I would be remiss to say that one of the reasons I'm a musician wouldn't be applause. I mean, the first time you perform solo, or the first time you sit down at the piano and get done with a recital, or do some performance and you hear that applause, there's something very human about what that praise feels like and what it means for where you're at. And I think kids respond to that as well because it drives acceptance. It's also what makes music making at the middle level so difficult, because at the middle level and as we cross into high school, that is both when we're craving acceptance but also trying to hide from it because we want to fit into the mold. So as kids, in particular, I think ensemble music making at the middle level is the most important because it provides a way to hide but be part of the, but get the acceptance. And then later on, the individual soloistic skills of students start to come out because they're starting to willing to take those risks. Middle level ensemble playing is huge.
We find in the conservatory, which is obviously second grade through 12th grade, but we have a second to seventh and then eighth through 12th. And with our students who are taking private lessons, so perhaps, you know, a little more motivated in some ways, but they enjoy the conservatory program because of its social connections.
Deal.
You know, they connect with kids from other schools. They're not just limited to the kids in, within their own school program, but they come from, obviously, from mid-Missouri, so from Fulton and from Mexico and from other places. And this whole being part of a team, I think, is really important to them. And being and that's something that is, I think, different than people just taking private lessons or piano lessons. If there are people out there with kids who play a orchestral instrument, then joining an orchestra program, I think, is vital to enhancing and just kind of motivating a lot of kids. They want to come on Monday, A, to learn about the music and have fun and enjoy the real experience of team making, but also to see friends and I think that's important.
Well, with a couple of minutes left, I wonder what your personal stories were, your motivations for getting into music first when you were a kid. Just a couple of minutes left, but yeah.
Well, youth orchestras was mine. I think that I started in youth orchestras when I was very young. They were vital to my life because, A, they were very good, but, B, because there was a sense of playing the great masterworks, but not being limited to it, and meeting other friends and other great musicians and being inspired by other musicians. I think that's one of the great things about programs, that we keep thinking that the only thing that can inspire a young musician is somebody who's 55 and, you know, has a famous name. No, they can be inspired by somebody the same age or a couple of years older.
Absolutely.
James and Greg, I wonder about you. What got you into it?
Sure, I definitely got to be in school band at a fairly early age in a school I went to in St. Louis. But there was a program when I was actually, I want to say fifth or sixth grade, that was very similar to what they have here, what you might have heard called the Blues in the Schools program, not to get away from classical music, but there was a blues artist that came to our music class and in my elementary school and basically just showed us what is essentially a very simple formula for the blues, basically three musical sentences and how they're supposed to go together. And just that simple structure and all the different ways that you could think of to, you know, experiment with that. It was like when you first learn how a haiku, you know, how to do a haiku. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, oh, man, okay, I know the syllables. Yes, exactly. I'm going to come up with a bunch of formulas and I'm going to do it. And it's like all the kids in that class that day were just, okay, I'm going to do this. I'm going to make the blues. You do the first line. And then you say that line again and you have the third line. It's just like, and slowly over time, you know, more interesting formulas and difficult things to learn about a music come along that keep you interested. Eventually, you may be tired of
James,
you
almost ran you out of time.
I think public television was my access to that as a kid. And I remember telling my junior high students, I said, when I grew up, I wanted to be a singing chef because I watched a lot of cooking shows on public access and could see orchestras and operas and all sorts of public concerts. So it started as a humorous thing and then became a skill set.
All right. Well, that is all the time we have for today's Intersection. Thanks to our guests, Kirk Trevor, the maestro of the Missouri Symphony Society, James Melton, the coordinator of the Fine Arts Department for Columbia Public Schools, and Greg Hausman, the director of the Columbia Academy of Music. We'd like to remind those of you enjoying this as rebroadcast that Intersection takes place live for a full hour from 2 to 3 every Monday afternoon. You can watch live streaming video of our program each Monday afternoon online at kbia.org. Alongside that video, you can submit your questions and comments and take part in an online discussion with others in the audience. You'll also find an archive of all of our past programs, including the full hour of today's conversation. Intersections are broadcast from the Reynolds Journalism Institute and is a project of RJI and KBIA. Intersections produced by Janet Saidi and Maureen Lewis Stump. Travis McMillan is our technical director with production assistance from Lowell Thomas. Pat Akers is our audio producer. Executive directors are Mike Dunn and Mike McKean. And I'm Ryan Famuliner. Thanks for joining us today and have a great week.